Hello and welcome to Choose Wisely. This is the podcast where we deconstruct food and sustainability topics with nuance and primary sources. Here we believe there are a lot of right ways to eat well and care about the environment, and that we can't change a food system we don't truly understand. I'm your host, Caroline Nelson, and on today's episode, we have a dream guest of mine. Dr. Frank Mittlener is a professor and air quality specialist at the Department of Animal Science at UC Davis. He shares his knowledge and research with students, scientists, farmers, ranchers, policymakers, and the public at large. He's the director of the CLEAR Center, which brings clarity to the intersection of animal agriculture and the environment. And their goal is to help our global community understand the environmental and human health impacts of livestock. That way, we can make informed decisions about the foods we eat while reducing environmental impacts. Frank received a Master of Science degree from the University of Leipzig, Germany, and a doctoral degree in animal science from Texas Tech. He was recruited in 2002 by UC Davis to fill its first ever position on the relationship between livestock and air quality. So there's so much that I appreciate about Dr. Mittlener, and I've been following his work for a long time. He was one of those dream guests that I emailed and thought there's no way, you know, he'll be able to make time, but he did, and I'm so grateful. Dr. Mittlener really advocates for diminishing and decreasing and working hard to lower methane emissions within agriculture, and also doing so in a way that is so contextualized and so nuanced and so not finger-pointy. We talk about that a lot at different points in the episode about the need to, within agriculture, to be real, to be honest, to be aggressive about our environmental impact and getting ahead of it, while also getting real on some of the data that has been overblown, that is missing context. For example, we talk a lot about methane and the ways in which it meaningfully differs from CO2 and why that matters so much and how it can actually make farmers and ranchers into environmental assets if they could be seen that way instead of environmental enemies. Dr. Mittlener is globally respected. He recently addressed the Irish Parliament on their proposal to cull several hundred thousand cattle as a way to diminish their emissions. We talk about that in the episode. He got on my radar because back in, oh my gosh, was this 2009, the UN FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, put out this big report called Livestock's Long Shadow, and it attributed 18% of global emissions to meat production. Now, that really hit kind of at a time when we were getting a lot of shockumentaries. There was a real like anti-cattle, anti-meat movement happening. It's still happening, but that was really kind of the beginning. And Livestock's Long Shadow played a really big role in that. And I always say, you can't unring a bell. So what happened was Dr. Mittlener uncovered in the way that they had done the math that essentially they were comparing a life cycle analysis of cows' emissions to a tailpipe analysis of the transportation industry, meaning only the emissions that come directly out of the tailpipe of a vehicle, not actually manufacturing the car, the battery, disposing of it, all these other factors. And so when you do that, it lowers the proportion of emissions attributed to the meat industry. And to their credit, the FAO responded and listened. And a little bit later, they put out a revision, 14.5%. And as we discussed in the episode, now the new numbers are, you know, that's over 10 years ago from their original report. So now we're at around 11% of global emissions to the meat industry. Again, this is still high. And Dr. Mittlener's point is not to say, well, it doesn't matter, it's only 11% now. It's to say, like, let's get an accurate handle on these numbers so that we can respond accordingly. And so we even have accurate benchmarks from which to start measuring against. So anyway, he came on my radar with that and is just somebody who is really esteemed in his industry. I did want to mention we have a little bit of audio issues on this episode. We had to use a different platform. And so you'll hear that. But just hang on, stick with it. It's just worth hanging on to every word. And this might even be an episode that you listen back to twice because it's just so thick with great information. All right, without further ado, this is my interview with Dr. Mittlener, and today we're asking, are cow burps causing climate change? Today's episode is brought to you by G5 Insurance. And if you're a rancher, farmer, or a small business owner, I want you to listen up, because G5 Agency insures everything that we do at Little Creek. These are our insurance agents, and they've been with us since the very beginning. I deal with a lot of different businesses through our work, and I am constantly blown away by how different it is working with G5. I feel like they actually know us. They're invested in us. They care about us. It feels like a very old-fashioned, personalized experience. Our agent will call me to check in. They will even send me a DM on Instagram. If I have any questions, I just know, I'm going to run this by Eric, or I'm going to shoot Lorraine an email. And they have really stayed with us as we've grown and really facilitated the growth of our business. Our insurance needs are complex. We're on a farm. We have heavy equipment. We work with livestock. We ship perishable food products. We run tourism events on different ranches with large animals, and we have business vehicles. Like, if you know anything about insurance, you know what a feat it is that we love our agents. G5 wasn't daunted by any of our needs. I am ride or die at this point, and I highly recommend them to anyone out there in need of business insurance. G5 can write in 48 states and has years of experience working with farms, ranches, and small businesses. You can find them at g5agency.com. Dr. Mittlener, thank you so much for being on Choose Wisely today. I have so much to ask, but first, I would love if you could just lay a groundwork for the audience in terms of understanding the difference between carbon emissions and methane emissions.
So when people refer to carbon emissions, they generally mean CO2, and CO2 is carbon dioxide. And that's emissions as a result of the burning of fossil fuel. But methane is also a carbonaceous gas. It's CH4, so it's also carbon emissions. But one molecule of methane is much more powerful in trapping heat from the sun than one molecule of CO2. But we can convert methane into CO2 equivalents, something that I don't really like to do, but most people do it, by simply multiplying the amount of methane a certain source has times 28, and then they call that CO2 equivalent.
So livestock essentially are under the microscope because they are burping CH4 methane. And as you mentioned, it's 28 times more potent than CO2. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you have this great bathtub metaphor that has really helped me understand the difference between a stock gas and a flow gas. Could you take us through that?
The way that carbon dioxide warms the planet is different from the way that methane warms the planet. And that is because CO2, carbon dioxide, once we burn fossil fuel, adds up and builds up in the atmosphere. So any time that you have ever driven a car, you generated CO2, all of that is still in the air. The same is true for the CO2 your parents' car and your grandparents' car put into the air. That carbon will stay in the air for 1,000 years, okay? So generally, when people look at methane, they act as if the methane that's belched out by a cow were to be accumulating too, with all that CO2 that was produced 20, 30, 40 years ago. But that's actually not true, because methane does not accumulate. It has a relatively short lifespan. And I like to explain it by using analogies, bathtub analogies, actually. Imagine one bathtub for CO2 and one bathtub for methane. The bathtub analogy for CO2 is one where you have this bathtub and you have a faucet, but you don't have a drain. Every time you turn on the faucet, whether you turn it on low, medium, or high, water is added to the bathtub and the water levels rise. The water levels can never go down because there's no drain. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's what CO2 does to warming. Every time we burn fossil fuel, we add new additional CO2, and that adds additional warming. Now comes the second analogy, the one for methane. Methane is not just produced, but methane is also destroyed, naturally destroyed by a process called oxidation. And that makes the bathtub analogy very different. Here we have a faucet, but we also have a drain. Mm-hmm. And the drain is always open. The drain stands for the oxidation process of methane in the atmosphere. So now our bathtub analogy is one where if you turn the faucet on normal, you add water to the bathtub, but an equal amount is let go off through the drain. As a result, the water level is stable. If we crank up that faucet all the way, then we can add more water to the bathtub than the drain would let out of, mm-hmm. and therefore the water levels could rise. And that's what happens when we increase methane over time, let's mm-hmm. say by doubling kettle herds in a certain part of the world or so, then we would add additional warming. So a constant amount of methane does not add additional warming. That's the bathtub analogy where the water level stays stable. Increasing amounts of methane would increase warming. But here, going back to our bathtub, what were to happen if we were to put the faucet on low? Then we would add fewer water to the bathtub mm-hmm. than the drain lets out of. And that means water levels would go down. And what that means is that if we were to reduce methane, we would be able to reduce warming. And what needs to be done is about a 0.3% reduction of methane per year leads to no additional warming by that source, let's say a cattle herd. So if we were to find some ways of reducing methane by 0.3% per year, we would not add additional warming to our planet. If we were to go even more aggressively, let's say 1% per year, then we would reduce warming. To some extent, if we reduce 20% or so over 20 years, then we would not add additional warming to our planet. If we go stronger, then we would even offset historic methane contributions from, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago.
It's so fascinating to me because we only ever hear the first part of what you're sharing about methane, about how much more potent it is. We don't hear about its incredibly, relatively short atmospheric lifespan, and it's why I'm so excited about cattle being a climate asset. I mean, essentially, if I'm understanding you correctly, immediately by making some very pretty modest emissions decreases, which maybe we do by, which is happening all the time in the US by greater genetic improvements in terms of raising more beef with fewer cattle, which we've been doing, we can be pretty quickly contributing to cooling, at least as a nation. Of course, there's the global cow herd, and that's different.
Yeah, so this is where we have to be very mindful of how we actually tell the story, mm-hmm. Because we don't want to be accused of greenwashing or right. creative accounting.
Right.
But we want to use a fact-based approach, and that fact-based approach is one where we say, not cows will cool the planet. I mean, that sounds too provocative to most. And we shouldn't say that. But what we should say is that a reduction of methane reduces warming. Mm-hmm. And a sector like the livestock sector is one whose main greenhouse gas is methane. Mm-hmm. And that's unique to our sector. Other sectors don't have methane as the main greenhouse gas, but CO2. But because we have methane as the main sector of, we have methane as the main greenhouse gas from our sector, reductions that we do will lead to a reduction of warming. Mm-hmm. And as you said, these reductions are very possible. They can be achieved through breeding. They can be achieved through health improvements. They can be achieved through feed additives. They can be achieved through manure management adjustments. And they can be achieved through improved soil carbon sequestration.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about all these new technologies. And you're right at the forefront of this research. And I want to come back to that. But first, I wanted to ask you, I am someone who's passionate about livestock and also passionate about the environment. And sometimes I come up against an attitude within the beef industry that basically says, la, 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 there's no problem here. We don't need to address any of this. It's all just, you know,
hot air.
Thank you. Hot air, exactly. Kind of a burying one's head in the sand approach. What would you say to a rancher or a feedlot operator or a farmer who just says we don't need to be worrying about this at all?
So oftentimes animal agriculture is portrayed as one of the leading sources of a changing climate. And globally, all livestock contributes to about 11%. Originally, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, thought it was 18%, then they went down to 14.5%. Now the global number, global, not US, mm-hmm. the global number is 11%. So they have changed several times. Now it's 11.
And that's in all livestock?
That's all livestock in the world.
Lamb, goats. Yes. Okay.
Yes. In the United States, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, all livestock combined emit 4% of all greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. So 4% is not nothing. It's something. Okay. Mm-hmm. About half of that comes from cattle. So now you might say, well, 2 or 3% is not that much. Well, if every sector were to say we are not that much, mm-hmm. then we wouldn't make any progress. I tell farmers and ranchers, while you're not a leading cause of a changing climate, you are part of it. Mm-hmm. And by understanding what part you play and by quantifying your contributions appropriately, you can then make reasonable steps to reduce your contributions. And that's what I'm all about. Some people think that Midlerner is saying, we don't have to worry about livestock emissions. I've never once said that. Mm-hmm. My entire research goes into the direction of helping farmers to appreciate their contributions and then work aggressively to further reduce them. Mm-hmm. And not just is it possible, it is doable. And it's even doable without breaking the bank. You could even have additional income streams by reducing these emissions, because losing methane is nothing else than losing energy. Mm-hmm. Methane is energy. If you consider that about 10% of the energy you feed to a cow is lost as methane, that's a net loss to production. Mm-hmm. All the methane that comes out of manure storages is a loss of energy. That's much like, you live in Montana, that's much like leaving your windows and doors open in the middle of winter. Mm-hmm. Nobody in their right mind would do that in Montana, because you would lose that expensive heat that you generated through mm-hmm. the burning of natural gas, for example. So people wouldn't do that. But they do it on farms by ignoring, not managing methane. Mm-hmm. If you do manage methane, you will have the advantage of making better use of a gas that is widely seen as a liability. Yet I see it more of an asset, because if you use it wisely, if you manage it wisely, you can convert that gas into transportation fuels. You can use that gas to produce power. We are doing it here in California. Yes. At large scale.
And I think one of the things that I really love about your approach is that it's very carrot, not stick. And I think what we see is, let's say we're harvesting methane being emitted from maybe manure lagoons on a dairy, or, you know, in other kind of consolidated manure scenarios, we're also solving other problems as well. So things like maybe there's some water runoff issues that are happening. You know, when we manage manure well, we have a cascading benefit. And then economically, there's benefits to farmers as well. And I also think that ranchers, we need to understand that if we want to do what we love and continue doing what we love, we have to hear people's concerns and act now, because this is good for the entire industry, to us, to show that, to in some ways reclaim the term environmentalist. I think ranchers love the land. And I think if we could get away from an us versus them mentality, and if others could maybe stop pointing fingers at us and invite us to the table, we would get a lot further.
You know, I'd like to say one word to that.
Yes. Because
you asked me what I say to ranchers and farmers who say, well, it's not a big deal, leave us alone and let's move on. Well, let's not forget that you produce food and your customers are organizations like Walmart, Sam's Club, McDonald's, and so on. And these organizations, they have set the goal to reduce their own company's carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And the majority of their own company's carbon footprint stems from their supply chains. In the case of beef and dairy, that's farmers and ranchers. They are not just looking away. They're saying, if you want to sell us your meat, if you want to sell us your milk, then show us what your current footprint is and how it has changed over the last 10, 20 years. And many and most of those farmers who are listening to us right now would say, I have no idea. I don't think anybody knows. We have never measured that, and so forth. And while that's true, in the future, it won't be good enough. These companies, these organizations who are your clients and your customers, they will say, in order for us to continue selling these products, these animal sourced food products, we need to know what the footprint is. And if you don't know what it is, we can buy our meat elsewhere, in Uruguay, in New Zealand, in Ireland, who knows where, in many of those places where they already know what their footprints are and how they have changed. So, I think it's really important for you to wake up to the fact that this is not some kind of political agenda behind it. I mean, some people might have an agenda, but there is a real fact-based reason behind reducing greenhouse gases. Our sector releases some of that. The methane is our central challenge to deal with. We can and we will meet that challenge.
I always love to point out that even if we don't care at all about global warming or anything like that, there are, like you said, economic benefits to making these strategic moves. I think about it too in terms of soil health. When we manage, we do rotational grazing and we've moved away from, or we've never used synthetic nitrogen inputs. These are things that all help kind of our carbon accounting on the farm. And I'm trying to make an investment now where in the future that will pay us back in bigger ways. So this is just a question that I have, and this is something I'm genuinely curious about. So as you mentioned, so we've got global emissions from livestock, 11%. I believe the last number I saw for all of agriculture, all of food production, it's somewhere around 25, 26%. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think we should probably stay with the livestock because otherwise it gets too convoluted. But yeah, I see.
Yeah, I am going somewhere with this.
I'm sorry?
I'm going somewhere with this.
Okay.
My question, I guess, is that yes, a quarter of all emissions to the food sector, it's a lot, it's substantial. But I also sort of wonder what should be our goal? I mean, to feed, it's like the most essential industry, in some ways kind of the essential industry. And sometimes I wonder, what are we supposed to be shooting for? I never hear anybody say, well, we need to get, it's just like lower, 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 without a thought of, is there a reasonable amount of global emissions we can just say, okay, we're okay with our food sector being X amount?
So let me first put a little nuance into this number that you're quoting there. So yes, in the United States, the animal agriculture sector is 4%. All of agriculture combined is around 10% of all greenhouse gases. That is the United States. If you now go to a country like Paraguay, the livestock sector makes up 50% of all greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. In Ethiopia, 90%. So if you now take 200 countries, many and most of which are developing countries and emerging countries, then their relative carbon footprint of livestock is high because their other sectors are not developed. For example, transportation system, power production and use, chemical industries, and so on. They're not developed. And so their main industry is agriculture. And because of that, the global percent of 25 is really relatively meaningless. Okay, it is heavily biased because of the fact that many of those 200 countries are developing countries. And that's why that global number of 25% looks large. Mm-hmm. Now, can we reduce these emissions globally? Absolutely, we can. Through technologies in most developed countries, technologies such as feed additives and manure technologies and so on. In developing countries, more through performance enhancements, better breeding, better healthcare, better genetics, and so forth. So the 25% should not be the looming number hanging over our heads, suggesting that livestock is something terrible. But we have to understand that we need to eat. We will continue need to eat. We mm-hmm. will need to produce more food in the future and not less. And yes. also way more animal source foods mm-hmm. rather than less. It's not going to happen that we will become a humanity of vegans. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. And so because of that, we have to think about how do we improve animal agricultural systems throughout the world to minimize their environmental footprint and make them part of a sustainable and wholesome food supply.
If I'm understanding you correctly, do you believe that as kind of other countries go through the process of becoming more developed, as a natural side effect, are those methane emissions going to come down or ag emissions going to come down and industry emissions going to go up? Is that just going to kind of be a natural byproduct?
Yes, there are several developments here. So first of all, in developing countries, let's say Ethiopia or Egypt or Kenya or so, other sectors will develop that currently are not in existence. Okay, so for example, power plants of sorts and chemical industries and so on, they will develop and they will take up a larger percent share of their national emission inventories. Mm-hmm. But when a nation is lifted out of poverty and people have more disposable income, then the first thing those parents of a family do is they buy some nutrient-dense food, such as eggs and meat and milk, to feed their kids particularly and their own parents, mm-hmm. the elderly, nutrient-dense food that they were starving of in the past. Mm-hmm. That's the first move. And because of that, the demand for animal source foods in developing countries is going skyrocket high.
Okay.
And it will continue to go skyrocket high. The question now is, because we can't say to them, look, what we have done here is something you can't do over there because of reasons A, B, C. They will do that like we have done it. But instead of telling them what to eat, we should offer them to learn lessons out of our history, mm-hmm. Lessons around how to improve genetics, how to improve animal care and health, how to improve reproduction.
Yes.
What kind of diets they can feed with their feedstock available to optimize production and so forth. That's how we could really assist them.
And I think that for the audience who maybe isn't so deep into livestock, something that's important for them to understand is that a cow is not a cow in terms of how much beef you're going to get off of it. In the US, I believe the numbers are we're raising 18% of the world's beef with 6% of the world's cattle herd. So meaning we've done a lot of that through selective breeding. We have bulkier carcasses, and our to overall cattle numbers in the US, I believe, have been going down as we continue to have really kind of strong and a lot of exports, and we're raising a ton of beef here. Whereas in places like India, you have, I believe it's called idle cows, where they're often not raised for beef there. And so we have kind of cattle that are roaming. Again, I don't really have a problem with that, but that's just one example of how in so many places in the world, we have idle or non-optimally performing livestock. And there's places like even in Brazil, they're raising tons of grass-fed beef, which gets imported into the US, and it's this considered, oh, it's so, you know, environmentally great, but they're coming off of much slimmer carcasses. It's a much less efficient style of beef production in terms of just volume. So that's just for the audience, if I'm saying all that correctly, to understand that there's technologies that we could be sharing with developing countries in the sense of here's some genetics, here's, you know, different feeds that convert really well. You don't have to spend 3 years finishing the steer. You can do it in a year and a half.
Yeah. So in the United States, we used to have 140 million beef cattle back in 1970. Today, we have 90 million. So we have 50 million fewer beef cattle, but we produce the same amount of beef as we used to with this much larger herd. You mentioned two countries, India and Brazil. These two countries combined have more cattle than the rest of the world combined.
Wow.
So we have 9 million dairy cows in the United States. In India, they have 300 million. And why do we have so many? You just mentioned the term idle cows, and that's a good term. They have so many because each individual cow is very low in her milk productivity, in her yield, meaning how much milk she produces. We are producing about 10 times more milk per cow in the United States as a cow in India.
Wow.
At least 10 times, if not 20 times. Now, why is there the term idle animals? That's because, just imagine your car were to be run in your driveway. So you have the engine on, but you're not driving it. You're just right. turning it on and it's now sitting in your driveway. It would be an idle car, polluting, but not transporting anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is exactly what happens to many of those cows in parts of Asia, in many parts of Africa, where the animal might be productive for a certain amount of time, not very productive, but still producing milk. But the second she stops, there's no more use for her because mm-hmm. she cannot produce anymore and she will not be eaten because she's considered holy in a mm-hmm. country like India. And so they open the gates of that dairy and they let that cow go out. And then that cow will roam like many dozens of other millions of cows, the streets of Indian cities. Nobody mm-hmm. takes care of those animals. They're just walking around aimlessly.
Mm-hmm.
They are eating, excreting, polluting, not producing milk and or meat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're called idle animals. And unfortunately, this is happening in many, many places in the world. The Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, IPCC, the world leading body on climate, has estimated that globally, 80% of all greenhouse gases from animal agriculture occur in developing countries.
Mm.
80%, mm-hmm. 20% in developed countries. Now, this is not Frank Midlener pointing fingers at others saying, mm-hmm. look, here's where the problem is. But we just have to be honest about where problems lie, how severe they are, and where we can make effective steps to mitigating those.
I think, right, and I'm glad that you said that we have this perspective now where all these developed countries have done all our big, big polluting, you know? And now we're like, guys, oh, you need to get your act together. And it can come across as very hypocritical. And I bring up idle cows. I think it can be a perspective shift for people. I'm not trying to say, well, they need to go shoot that cow the minute it's not producing milk. You know, that's not what I'm saying. But I think when you say we have, just through genetics, we have dairy cows that are producing 10 times or more as much milk for the same inputs. They're very similar inputs.
Yeah.
This is just very important nuance. I want to go, we've been looking a little bit to the future and what's going to happen. I want to go back in time. So before colonization in North America, we had an estimated, I believe it's 30 to 60 million bison here. The numbers vary. I've seen as high as 100 million, but that varies. Not to mention we had other large grazing ungulates. A lot of them have been eradicated, like the bison. We're now down to 500,000 bison today. Bison emissions, if I'm correct, would be considered biogenic, right? Like part of the natural carbon cycle and not something that would be human caused, like the load of the wild animals on a landscape. Is that correct?
Yeah. So just with respect to your numbers, 250 years ago, we had an estimated 60 million bison and 40 million large antelope. So that's taking together 100 million large ruminants in the United States. Today, we have 90 million beef and 9 million mm-hmm. dairy cows. If you add that up, it's, again, almost 100 million.
It's pretty close.
250 years ago, we had about the same number of large ruminants as we do today.
And you see where I'm going with this. And I'm not trying, this is, again, where I can get accused of creative accounting, and I'm not trying to do that. What I'm curious about, because our domestic livestock are considered anthropogenic methane emissions, you know, human-caused, and then they are. But what I'm wondering is whether for each landscape, there can be some kind of understanding that there is an innate sort of biological wild or like ruminant methane load that kind of can go with this landscape. And as you've said, in North America, there is a case to be made that we're not too far away from that methane load.
Yeah, you see, that the trouble is, while many people like that comparison, and it is kind of it's kind of interesting to know that today we have almost as many large ruminants as we used to in the pre-colonization age 250 years ago. That's interesting, but it's inconsequential. The agencies couldn't care less how many animals there were 250 years ago and whether they were wild or nobody of importance in this field doing inventories and so on cares about that. It's just simply interesting to people to hear this, but it doesn't have anything to do with you know, whether or not farmers are getting off the hook. They are not getting off the hook because the current livestock herd is associated with human activity. With that, it's characterized or categorized as anthropogenic, and because of that, we need to mitigate it. There is no category for, let's say, wild deer today and the hope that we reduce emissions from those. They are considered as biogenic as a volcano or a swamp or a, you know, anything else in nature. And so whether we find that justified, logical, and so on or not, that's just how
it doesn't matter. Got it. The Irish government recently released a proposal to cull 200,000 dairy cows to lower their national methane emissions. Do you think that's a worthwhile endeavor?
Yeah, so I talked to, I was recently in Rome at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, and I talked to people in their government, in the Irish government. While that proposal is on the table, it's just that, a proposal. I had been asked last year to give testimony before the Irish Parliament, and I told them why I think it's a poor idea. So why is it a poor idea in my assessment? So the majority of what the Irish produce goes into export. So they have about, you know, so the majority of their dairy and meat and so on goes into export. If they were now to get rid of a sizable chunk of their herd, let's say 200,000, then there would still be the demand for the products these 200 cows would normally produce. And instead of the Irish, that supply would now be produced by somebody else, the Brazilians or the Germans or the Australians, by somebody else. And that somebody else would then emit those emissions that now no longer come from Ireland, but now from wherever, Brazil, Germany, and so on. That's called leakage. You are not reducing emissions. You're just moving them from one part of the world to another part of the world. And that would lower economic output of the Irish, and somebody else would benefit from it, but it would not reduce emissions.
You've really helped me understand this concept of leakage in the sense that I think there's a lot of calls in developed nations right now, certainly in Europe and the US, to reduce. And I guess something I just want to underscore for listeners is we want to be reducing methane, but reducing cattle and reducing products that we're supplying does not necessarily solve our emissions problem globally. And those emissions may instead be outsourced to a less efficient country. For example, let's say we quit raising beef here, we're going to be importing more from Brazil, and they have a ton more cows raised less efficiently. So these are very just complicated problems. And I love your approach of looking at efficiency and looking at management while we can keep producing the same amount, but keep lowering overall emissions.
If you want to reduce emissions, emissions, and we should, then you should invest in mitigation, and that mitigation can get us to very sizable reductions of 20, 30, 40% of methane, of nitrous oxide, and so on. We know how to do it. Now we need to get to it. But there are people who are in the anti-livestock, anti-animal source foods camp, and they are absolutely myopically focused on changing what people eat. They want people to switch from the current diet that people consume, which, by the way, means that in 97 to 98% of all refrigerators in the United States, you find animal source foods. Okay, the vast majority eats animal source foods. There's a small minority that thinks we should stop that. But we're not going to. It's not realistic. And so to me, the question then is, if we don't change what we eat, how can we help our farmers to reduce emissions? And how can we do it without breaking the bank?
I want to ask you one more question about sort of overall numbers. And I don't want to be too hung up on this. I am never trying to minimize ranchers and farmers' emissions at all. I feel like having a firm grasp on the numbers is so important. And that's why I get so frustrated when we don't. And you mentioned earlier that the UN, the FAO originally released this report, Livestock's Long Shadow, attributing 18% of emissions to meat production, and then they lowered it. And I did want to shout out that they lowered it because of your critiques. And I have to imagine that at the time, there was maybe some eye rolling hearing from you on that, but they did. They came down to 14.5. And as you mentioned, now they're down to 11%. I mean, that is a pretty sizable reduction. And I'm curious, what did that, was that a great day when you saw there was a revision? Did they credit your work at all?
I have been given some serious kudos because not everybody acknowledges when making mistakes, they have. And I think it was an honest mistake. The main item in Livestock's Long Shadow that I critiqued was in the executive summary, where they stated that globally, livestock produces more greenhouse gas emissions than the transportation sector.
Right.
Meaning cows and pigs and sheep and chickens produce more greenhouse gases than all cars, trucks, trains, planes, ships in the world combined. I went to the roots of that, and I found that they use different methodologies to assess the impact livestock has on climate versus those transportation has on climate. And I published that criticism, and they agreed with my criticism. Later, I became chairman of a global FAO partnership project called LEAP, L-E-A-P, and worked with hundreds of scientists to quantify, or first to develop guidelines on how to quantify emissions from livestock to air, to water, to climate, to biodiversity, and so on. And these are now gold standard documents that are for the world scientists to be used. So I'm actually quite pleased that they were open to criticism, that they have made changes. And so this is the way it should be. When I make a mistake, I will be the first one to own it. And that's the proper way to do things.
Sort of a question about maybe scientific culture and maybe just sort of our culture. I do a lot of debunking on the podcast, again, never to minimize livestock's impact, but just to accurately measure it. So one example was beef's water use and consumption, the widespread claim from UNESCO that takes 1,800 gallons of water to make 1 pound of ground beef. And I just read the UNESCO study, and I found that number one, that data doesn't apply to the U.S. That's a global number. Again, inefficient systems. They're slaughtering steers at 3 years old. We're not doing that here. And also that 94% of that comes from rain, green water. And so just by sharing that news, a lot of people were kind of blown away to hear that. And they said, well, that really does change how I think about, you know, I understand this isn't coming from an aquifer. It's not coming from a stream. And I actually care more about blue water and where the water is actually coming from. My question is, like, I'm not a scientist. I'm imagining that so many other people have read this nuance, so many other people with PhDs and better equipped than I am to share this nuance. Yet, how, as a sort of our mainstream understanding of beef in particular's climate impact, how are we so far off base in terms of really what's accurate or what the crux of the real environmental problems?
Well, like every sector of society, science evolves and our knowledge about different aspects of it evolves. What we thought to know 30 years ago about methane is no longer what we think about methane. I want to be very clear. I'm not in any way downplaying the importance of methane.
No,
I think methane is a very potent and important greenhouse gas that we want to reduce. But I also want to say that methane is a problem if we ignore it, if we don't do anything about it. If we increase it over time, we have a big problem. It will add a lot of additional warming. We don't want to do that. If we learn to hold it constant, then it has a lesser impact on additional warming, if any. But if we manage it, then we can reduce warming. And that means we can make our farmers and ranchers part of a climate solution. Because if they reduce 10, 20, 30, 40% of methane, then they will reduce warming. Here in California, our farmers are doing that. They have already achieved 30% of their methane goal.
Wow.
And that's validated and certified by the state of California. And they get paid for it. Because in addition to just selling milk, let's say, as a dairy, they're now also converting biogas that they have trapped from manure storages. And they're converting that biogas into transportation fuels to then power and fuel heavy-duty trucks and buses. And so instead of burning diesel, these buses and trucks are now burning what used to be a waste product of the animal manure.
Mm-hmm.
So we have turned something that was a liability into something that's an asset. And our farmers can do that. So my goal is to appreciate, to have a different appreciation for those people in our country and in the world that feed us.
Mm-hmm.
And help those farmers and ranchers not just continue to feed us, but also minimize their own environmental footprint and maybe even produce new product streams that further our sustainability as a society.
You think that our mainstream understanding of animal agriculture's impact is going to mature? Do you think these ideas are going to trickle down into the mainstream?
Oh, I know that for sure. And I see that the reasonable consumer out there, the one who does appreciate animal source foods, but wants to be assured that it's raised in a way that's responsible from an animal welfare perspective, from an environmental perspective, from a worker perspective, from a food safety perspective, and so on. They want to be assured that what they are consuming there was responsibly raised. And we as farmers and ranchers have a responsibility to make that happen and to communicate it. And this is where farmers and ranchers are notoriously weak. They're very good at producing food. They are very poor communicating how they produce food. And
yes,
because of that, there are certain people out there who think they can do a better job communicating it. These guys might be well-meaning, but they're all too often not well-informed. And they are putting out a narrative that's badly disruptive and destructive of our agricultural force. We cannot afford that as a nation. If you think, I don't mean you, I mean the third person, if one thinks that we have a very solid food supply, that we don't have to worry about things, well, that's not really true. Read the last agricultural census and you will find that we will have a surprisingly low number of farmers and ranchers producing the vast majority of our food. And that they are on average close to 60 years of age. That's the average age, close to 60. And that means they're close to retirement age. And so I'm talking to people, my students here, I have hundreds of students at UC Davis. We have 1,500 undergraduate students in animal science here. I tell them, don't think that our farmers are a resource that we just have forever. The standing of our farmers and ranchers in society is in peril. Okay. And they feel not very appreciated because by many, they aren't very appreciated.
Yes.
That has to change.
When I first got into ranching, it was almost like something I felt I had to be embarrassed about, going home to my family at Thanksgiving, not my immediate family, but you know, the aunts and uncles. I'm like, I always joke that I would kind of whisper like I'm a rancher, you know? And I think you're absolutely right in saying that it's very short-sighted to make certain sectors of our food industry kind of the scapegoats, the punching bags. I don't have any data, but I'm very curious about sort of the mental health effects on that, on farmers and ranchers. And I think it also creates an industry that's very defensive and is not going to want to listen to the next thing out of your mouth, even if there's something important there that we could all benefit from. Okay. A big claim against the beef industry is that it contributes to deforestation, particularly in the Amazon. And that's a big carbon sink, very important. And therefore, eating more beef contributes to more carbon emissions. Would eating less beef help the Amazon?
Yeah, so you mentioned that before, that you mentioned that Brazil might supply a significant amount of the beef that we eat. Mm-hmm. It actually is not the case. In the United States, we are importing less than 0.5% of all beef from Brazil.
What I was thinking of was, isn't it a very large percent of our grass-fed beef is Brazilian?
No.
No? I'm totally wrong on that?
A very small percentage of the beef that we import in this country is from Brazil. They're vast. The number one export country is China. Mm. The second one is Egypt. And the third one, I forgot what the third one is, but the vast majority goes to China. Okay. We are actually importing very little Brazilian beef here in the United States. But it is true what you're saying, namely that beef production in Brazil does eat into the rainforest. It does lead to deforestation of the rainforest. And I think that needs to be halted. I think mm-hmm. that they have a lot of suitable land for grazing, and that land should be utilized. It has been cleared decades ago. They have to make sure that it stays fertile enough to be a proper grassland. But biting big chunks of rainforest out of the Amazon every year is not something that they will continue to defend or be able to defend. Mm-hmm. And it gives the world a black eye, the world beef production, but also the world agricultural production. And that's not just true for beef, by the way. When it comes to rainforest, it also is an issue of Indonesia and many places in Asia, where we are taking down rainforests and we are planting palm oil plantations, yes. mm-hmm. or soy plantations and so on. And then that palm oil goes into European vehicles as a diesel additive. Mm. About 6% of all diesel in the European Union stems from Indonesian palm oil plantations. And they have replaced what used to be rainforest. I'm not trying to deflect of the Brazilian Amazon issue that needs to be addressed, mm-hmm. but we are really dealing with deforestation in those tropical areas throughout the world, and mm-hmm. all players need to really be on it to minimize or get it down to zero.
Thank you so much for that context and that nuance. Something that I think about a lot is that we should be raising and farming in general, raising beef or farming rice where it's ecologically appropriate to do so. And it's just simply it doesn't make a ton of sense to just clear rainforest to raise cattle there, just ecologically. But here in Montana, it's a completely different story. We're the home of the large ruminants, and there are keystone species here. And something else that you said, something I really want to talk about on this podcast is, if we don't want to support beef that deforests the Amazon, we can avoid imported beef. But the problem is we have a loophole in labeling laws where if beef is processed here rather than raised here, it can still be marked a product of the USA. So I'm a big proponent of just closing that gap so the consumers can have more information. On this podcast, I've been very critical of kind of big food and agribusiness funding, and in particular, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. I just did an episode on that where basically they get a lot of funding from Kraft and PepsiCo and Nestle. And there was a FOIA request on their internal documents that show them kind of modifying some of their recommendations based on concerns from like the Dairy Council and things like that. And so I just want to be consistent here. There was a New York Times piece that came out last year that was very critical of UC Davis Clear Center and basically was, in my opinion, trying to say, well, we don't need to listen to Dr. Mittlener because, he's bought and paid for by big meat. So what would you say to people who feel that way and want to write off your research?
Well, I'm an agricultural scientist. And my job description says that I need to work with agriculture to mm-hmm. help agriculture reduce emissions. So naturally, the entities that produce technologies that help us reduce emissions are agricultural companies. Right. And so when I do research on emission mitigation, then these companies will fund that research. If I were not an agricultural scientist, but if I were, let's say, a vehicle emission expert, then I would work with Ford and Mercedes and General Motors to help them build catalytic converters and other stuff. But I don't work with cars. I work with cows. And that is why some of the mitigation that I study is funded by those companies that produce mitigation approaches. The vast majority of my funding comes from federal and state agencies, but rightfully so, the agricultural community pays some of that research in order to help us arrive at solutions that work. And because I'm not just a professor teaching students and doing research, I'm also an extension specialist, it makes perfect sense that the communication I do with the agricultural sector is supported by the agricultural sector, because farmers and ranchers, many of whom you are doing this podcast for, want to know what's real. Yeah. What are my emissions? Shall I care for those? Do I need to mitigate those? They want to understand what all of that means. And I'm communicating that in an extension fashion. That's my job. And I will continue doing that, whether some people like it or not.
And I want to say, I really appreciate it. There's been so many resources I've come across where it feels like the CLEAR Center and UC Davis are really standing alone in terms of doing this research and kind of leading the way. And if it seems to me, in terms of a lot of mainstream media, that there's a lot of finger pointing and not a lot of solutions oriented approaches. To me, it gets to something bigger of why it can come across just simply as anti-agriculture, anti-farmer, to think that, we don't need to be working as an industry to solve these problems. If we weren't doing anything, we'd get criticized for that too.
I mean, here's the deal. If animal agriculture were to say, we don't believe in this, and,
and some people do,
a bunch of hot air around cows and climate, we don't have anything to do with that. We are ignoring this issue. Then everybody out there in the mainstream would say, look at these farmers. They're not doing anything. They're not taking on their responsibility. We are. I mean, if it is very clear, if you read anything that comes from the CLEAR Center that I'm directing, if you read our documents, you will find that we are very clear about what the impact of animal agriculture is on the environment, where we see hotspots that need to be addressed, how they shall and can be addressed. We work with farmers to implement those changes. You can imagine that a farmer will not put in hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of technology onto their farm or ranch if they do not trust the person who has researched that.
Right.
That shouldn't be surprising to anybody. So I have built trust with my sector, the agricultural sector. And without it, I would not be effective. Okay. For being, for doing that, and then being accused of being too close to agriculture, to me, it's just ridiculous. But what is encouraging to me is that even if you get, let's say, a whole page New York Times article flung against you, and that was really a hit piece.
Everybody
who reads this, many journalists told me this is a classical hit piece. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the good thing is they can write what they want. I, within the same day, wrote a rebuttal. 54 million people read both the original piece and my rebuttal, and 75% were on my side. And that is not typical, because normally a hit piece will end in a pretty sad situation for the person who had been aimed at. That was not the case for us.
I did want to also point out, in reading the article, they had a line tucked right in the middle that says, well, we haven't found any evidence that the data has actually been affected by any of these funding sources. I thought that was funny, because I thought, well, wasn't that the implication behind the piece?
Right.
Anyway, right. So thank you for humoring me with that one. I want to be always, I just want to be consistent when I talk about these big topics. Thank you so much, Dr. Miltner, for making the time today. And I'm just excited to keep following your work. Thank you so much on behalf of all the ranchers for what you're doing. And thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And my greetings to the beautiful state of Montana.
Thanks for having me. Oh my gosh. Okay. It was such an honor to have Dr. Miltner on. thank you to Frank for making the time in your incredibly busy schedule. I did want to follow up and just do a little bit of circling back on, there was kind of a moment in the interview where I had said, you know, if the US stops importing beef, we're going to be importing it from Brazil even more than we already are. And I think I mentioned there's like a lot of Brazilian beef coming in. And Dr. Mittlener basically said, no, that's a myth. You know, we're getting not even 1% of our imports from Brazil. So you don't really need to worry about the Amazonian rainforest based on, you know, consuming beef in the US. It's like kind of a non-issue. So I did want to, like, I followed up on that. And I think he probably has way better stats than me. And so what I'm seeing, I'm on Statistica. I'm seeing that in 2022, the US imported 14% of our imported beef from Brazil. So we imported 30% from Canada, 22% from Mexico, 14% from Brazil. And so that would be our third largest. Now, that's just of the imported beef. We have a lot of domestic beef that we raise. But also, I think it's possible that we were just talking about slightly different things. And so that's where we had a little data quibbling. And I wasn't able to find good stats on what percent of our grass-fed imports come from Brazil. But that's the number that I've heard is kind of, that's where you're going to get a greater percentage of Brazilian beef because they're not really doing grain finishing as much down there. Anyway, just wanted to mention that. I don't have anything super firm to follow that up with, but just putting a pin in that for now because I do want to do a whole episode on Brazil and beef and the Amazon. And anyway, we'll have to circle back to that one. Thank you so much for joining me today on Choose Wisely. I hope your next meal is delicious and your next conversation nuanced. And thank you again to G5 Agency for coming on and bringing this podcast to us all. We really encourage you to check them out at g5agency.com for your small business, farm, and ranch insurance needs. If you like this podcast, take 10 seconds, give us a rating and review, and find us on Instagram at Choose Wisely Podcast. On Patreon, you can become a regenerator and join us over there for exclusive episodes at patreon.com/choosewiselypodcast. And if you have a guest suggestion or you want to drop us a line, we're at choosewiselypodcast@gmail.com.